Chapter 3. Not much time to see. They quickly entered the carriage, and it moved on. Then a cat suddenly mewed, and he saw a white Persian standing forlorn, where the carriage had been. The door was opened, the cat taken in, and the carriage drove away. The stranger's girlish form stamped itself deeply on Somerset's soul. He strolled on his way quite oblivious to the fact that the moon had just risen, and that the landscape was one for him to linger over, especially if there were any Gothic architecture in the line of the lunar rays. The inference was that, though this girl must be of a serious turn of mind, willfulness was not foreign to her composition. And it was probable that her daily doings evinced without much abatement by religion the unbroken spirit and pride of life natural to her age. The little village in at which Somerset intended to pass the night lay a mile further on, and retracing his way up to the stile he rambled along the lane, now beginning to be streaked like a zebra with the shadows of some young trees that etched the road. But his attention was attracted to the other side of the way by a hum, as of a night bee, which arose from the play of the breezes over a single wire of telegraph running parallel with his track on tall poles, that had appeared by the road, he hardly knew when, from a branch route, probably leading from some town in the neighborhood to the village he was approaching. He did not know the population of Sleeping Green, as the village of his search was called, but the presence of this mark of civilization seemed to signify that its inhabitants were not quite so far in the rear of their age as might be imagined. A glance at the still ungrassed heap of earth round the foot of each post was, however, sufficient to show that it was at no very remote period that they had made their advance. Aided by this friendly wire, Somerset had no difficulty in keeping his course, till he reached a point in the ascent of a hill at which the telegraph branched off from the road, passing through an opening in the hedge, to strike across an undulating down, while the road wound round to the left. For a few moments Somerset doubted and stood still. The wire sang on overhead with dying falls, and melodious rises that invited him to follow. While above the wire rode the stars in their courses, the low nocturne of the former seeming to be the voices of those stars, still choiring to the young-eyed cherubim. Recalling himself from these reflections, Somerset decided to follow the lead of the wire. It was not the first time during his present tour that he had found his way at night by the help of these musical threads which the post office authorities had erected all over the country for quite another purpose than to guide belated travelers. Plunging with it across the down, he came to a hedgeless road that entered a park or chase, which flourished in all its original wildness. Tufts of rushes and brakes of fern rose from the hollows, and the road was in places half overgrown with green, as if it had not been tended for many years, so much so that, where shaded by trees, he found some difficulty in keeping it. Though he had noticed the remains of a deer fence further back, no deer were visible, and it was scarcely possible that there should be any in the existing state of things. But rabbits were multitudinous, every hillock being dotted with their seated figures till Somerset approached, and sent them limping into their burrows. The road next wound round a clump of underwood beside which lay heaps of faggots for burning, and then there appeared against the sky the walls and towers of a castle, half ruin, half residence, standing on an eminence hard by. Somerset stopped to examine it. The castle was not exceptionally large, but it had all the characteristics of its most important fellows. Irregular, dilapidated, and muffled in creepers as a great portion of it was, some part a comparatively modern wing was inhabited, for a light or two steadily gleamed from some upper windows. In others a reflection of the moon denoted that unbroken glass yet filled their casements. Over all rose the keep, a square solid tower apparently not much injured by wars or weather, and darkened with ivy on one side, wherein wings could be heard flapping uncertainly, as if they belonged to a bird unable to find a proper perch. Hissing noises supervened, and then a hoot, proclaiming that a brood of young owls were residing there in the company of older ones. In spite of the habitable and more modern wing, neglect and decay had set their mark upon the outworks of the pile, unfitting them for a more positive light than that of the present hour. He walked up to a modern arch spanning the ditch now dry and green over which the drawbridge once had swung. The large door under the porter's archway was closed and locked. While standing here, the singing of the wire, which for the last few minutes he had quite forgotten, again struck upon his ear, and retreating to a convenient place, he observed its final course. From the poles amid the trees it leaped across the moat, over the girdling wall, and thence by a tremendous stretch towards the keep where, to judge by sound, it vanished through a narrow slit into the interior. This fossil of feudalism, then, was the journey's end of the wire, and not the village of Sleeping Green. There was a certain unexpectedness in the fact that the hoary memorial of a stolid antagonism to the interchange of ideas, the monument of hard distinctions in blood and race, of deadly mistrust of one's neighbor in spite of the church's teaching, and of a sublime unconsciousness of any other force than a brute one, should be the goal of a machine which beyond everything may be said to symbolize cosmopolitan views, and the intellectual and moral kinship of all mankind. In that light the little buzzing wire had a far finer significance to the student Somerset than the vast walls which neighbored it. But the modern fever and fret which consumes people before they can grow old was also signified by the wire, and this aspect of today did not contrast well with the fairer side of feudalism: leisure, light-hearted generosity, intense friendships, hawks, hounds, revels, healthy complexions, freedom from care, and such a living power in architectural art as the world may never again see. Somerset withdrew till neither the singing of the wire, nor the hisses of the irritable owls, could be heard any more. A clock in the castle struck 10, and he recognized the strokes as those he had heard when sitting on the stile. It was indispensable that he should retrace his steps and push on to Sleeping Green, if he wished that night to reach his lodgings, which had been secured by letter at a little inn in the straggling line of roadside houses called by the above name, where his luggage had by this time probably arrived. In a quarter of an hour he was again at the point where the wire left the road, and following the highway over a hill he saw the hamlet at his feet. 3. By 10:30 the next morning Somerset was once more approaching the precincts of the building which had interested him the night before. Referring to his map, he had learned that it bore the name of Stancy Castle or Castle de Stancy, and he had been at once struck with its familiarity, though he had never understood its position in the county, believing it further to the west. If report spoke truly, there was some excellent vaulting in the interior, and a change of study from ecclesiastical to secular Gothic was not unwelcome for a while. The entrance gate was open now, and under the archway the outer ward was visible, a great part of it being laid out as a flower garden. This was in process of clearing from weeds and rubbish by a set of gardeners, and the soil was so encumbered that in rooting out the weeds such few hardy flowers as still remained in the beds were mostly brought up with them. The groove wherein the portcullis had run was as fresh as if only cut yesterday, the very tooling of the stone being visible. Close to this hung a bell pull formed of a large wooden acorn attached to a vertical rod. Somerset's application brought a woman from the porter's door, who informed him that the day before having been the weekly show day for visitors, it was doubtful if he could be admitted now. "Who is at home?" said Somerset. "Only Miss de Stancy," the porteress replied. His dread of being considered an intruder was such that he thought at first there was no help for it but to wait till the next week. But he had already, through his want of effrontery, lost a sight of many interiors, whose exhibition would have been rather a satisfaction to the inmates than a trouble. It was inconvenient to wait. He knew nobody in the neighborhood from whom he could get an introductory letter. He turned and passed the woman, crossed the ward where the gardeners were at work, over a second and smaller bridge, and up a flight of stone stairs, open to the sky, along whose steps sunburned Tudor soldiers, and other renowned dead men had doubtless many times walked. It led to the principal door on this side. Thence he could observe the walls of the lower court in detail, and the old mosses with which they were padded mosses, that from time immemorial had been burnt brown every summer, and every winter had grown green again. The arrow slit and the electric wire that entered it, like a worm uneasy at being unearthed, were distinctly visible now. So also was the clock, not, as he had supposed, a chronometer coeval with the fortress itself, but new and shining, and bearing the name of a recent maker. The door was opened by a bland, intensely shaven man out of livery, who took Somerset's name and politely worded request to be allowed to inspect the architecture of the more public portions of the castle. He pronounced the word architecture in the tone of a man who knew and practiced that art. For, apostrophe he said to himself, if she thinks I am a mere idle tourist, it will not be so well. ... No such uncomfortable consequences ensued. Miss D'Estancy had great pleasure in giving Mr. Somerset full permission to walk through whatever parts of the building he chose. He followed the butler into the inner buildings of the fortress, the ponderous thickness of whose walls made itself felt like a physical pressure. An internal stone staircase, ranged round four sides of a square, was next revealed, leading at the top of one flight into a spacious hall, which seemed to occupy the whole area of the keep. From this apartment a corridor floored with black oak led to the more modern wing, where light and air were treated in a less gingerly fashion. Here passages were broader than in the oldest portion, and upholstery enlisted in the service of the fine arts hid to a great extent the coldness of the walls. Somerset was now left to himself, and roving freely from room to room he found time to inspect the different objects of interest that abounded there. Not all the chambers, even of the habitable division, were in use as dwelling rooms, though these were still numerous enough for the wants of an ordinary country family. In a long gallery with a coved ceiling of arabesques which had once been gilded, hung a series of paintings representing the past personages of the D'Estancy line. It was a remarkable array, even more so on account of the incredibly neglected condition of the canvases than for the artistic peculiarities they exhibited. Many of the frames were dropping apart at their angles, and some of the canvas was so dingy that the face of the person depicted was only distinguishable as the moon through mist. For the color they had now, they might have been painted during an eclipse, while, to judge by the webs tying them to the wall, the spiders that ran up and down their backs were such as to make the fair originals shudder in their graves. He wondered how many of the lofty foreheads and smiling lips of this pictorial pedigree could be credited as true reflections of their prototypes. Some were willfully false, no doubt, many more so by unavoidable accident and want of skill. Somerset felt that it required a profounder mind than his to disinter from the lumber of conventionality the lineaments that really sat in the painter's presence, and to discover their history behind the curtain of mere tradition. The painters of this long collection were those who usually appear in such places: Holbein, Jansen, and Van Dyck, Sir Peter, Sir Geoffrey, Sir Joshua, and Sir Thomas. Their sitters, too, had mostly been Sirs, Sir William, Sir John, or Sir George D'Estancy, some undoubtedly having a nobility stamped upon them beyond that conferred by their robes and orders, and others not so fortunate. Their respective ladies hung by their sides feeble and watery, or fat and comfortable, as the case might be, also their fathers and mothers-in-law, their brothers and remoter relatives, their contemporary reigning princes, and their intimate friends. Of the D'Estancy's pure there ran through the collection a mark by which they might surely have been recognized as members of one family, this feature being the upper part of the nose. Every one, even if lacking other points in common, had the special indent at this point in the face, sometimes moderate in degree, sometimes excessive. while looking at the pictures which, though not in his regular line of study, interested Somerset more than the architecture, because of their singular dilapidation, it occurred to his mind that he had in his youth been schoolfellow for a very short time with a pleasant boy bearing a surname attached to one of the paintings the name of Ravensbury. The boy had vanished, he knew, not how. He thought he had been removed from school suddenly on account of ill health. But the recollection was vague, and Somerset moved on to the rooms above and below. In addition to the architectural details, of which he had as yet obtained but glimpses, there was a great collection of old movables, and other domestic artwork all more than a century old, and mostly lying as lumber. There were suites of tapestry hangings, common and fine, green and scarlet leather work, on which the gilding was still but little injured. Venerable damask curtains, quilted silk table covers, ebony cabinets, worked satin window cushions, carved bedsteads, and embroidered bed furniture which had apparently screened no sleeper for these many years. Downstairs there was also an interesting collection of armor, together with several huge trunks and coffers. A great many of them had been recently taken out and cleaned, as if a long dormant interest in them were suddenly revived. Doubtless they were those which had been used by the living originals of the phantoms that looked down from the frames. This excellent hoard of suggestive designs for woodwork, metalwork, and work of other sorts, induced Somerset to divert his studies from the ecclesiastical direction, to acquire some new ideas from the objects here for domestic application. Yet for the present he was inclined to keep his sketchbook closed and his ivory rule folded, and devote himself to a general survey. Emerging from the ground floor by a small doorway, he found himself on a terrace to the northeast, and on the other side than that by which he had entered. It was bounded by a parapet breast high, over which a view of the distant country met the eye, stretching from the foot of the slope to a distance of many miles. Somerset went and leaned over, and looked down upon the tops of the bushes beneath. The prospect included the village he had passed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.